They're dishonest. They're unpatriotic. And so I ask you, how, when we're doing this, how are people going to have faith in government? Why are the next great scientists, the next great leaders going to want to work with the United States government? What a loss for us at a time when our government really helped create the internet, helped create antibiotics, helped create sensors, and we're going to now diminish government at a time where we need a strong government partnership with the private sector and research universities for America to compete. So the Republicans, it's not just this president. It's important to understand that they're inflicting so much damage on the institutions of our democracy and government.
Finally, will these impeachment hearings be televised?
Yes, they absolutely will. They will be televised. The testimony will be public. And Republicans will get to ask questions. But I think here's what the Republicans
are
realizing.
We got to leave it there.
The attack on process isn't going to work. They have no defense for the conduct of the president.
Congressmember Rokana, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. And the time is 5 o'clock. And KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Jupiter Hotel, a mid-century Portland Motor Inn-turned hotel, located at 800 East Burnside Street, less than 1 mile from the convention and Moda centers, and Jupiter Next, a 67-room independent boutique hotel. Booking and more information online at jupiterhotel.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Outside the Frame trains homeless and marginalized youth to be directors of their own films and lives. Their annual gala showcases a collection of short films by and about invisible communities in plain sight, young Honduran trans women who walk to Oregon, houseless folks forced to migrate in their hometown, and much more. Again, that's Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studio in Portland. Educata Ya hosts Dia de los Muertos featuring decorative altars, people dressed up as Katrinas, reading of the satirical Calaveras, and a traditional Pan de Muerto. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studios, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is excited to announce that we will be a stop on Southeast Portland's First Friday Art Walk on November 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. We will be filling our studios with beautiful artwork from local artists, great music, and drinks and snacks. Also, get a chance to tour our legendary station. The First Friday Art Walk is in Portland's vibrant East Side Arts District and includes more than 23 galleries. Hop just around the corner to the Art Walk event at the Jupiter Hotel. You can find a map of participating galleries at firstfridaypdx.org. So come out to KBOO in the name of art, music, and drinks. Friday, November 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. See you then.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the House votes yes on impeachment.
Oregon lawmakers have some strong reactions to this historic vote.
And a local startup tries to help teachers teach computer programming.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, October 31st, 2019. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Althea Billings. A bitterly divided House of Representatives voted today to endorse the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry into President Trump. It's a historic action that set up a new public phase of the process, and it underscores the political polarization in our country. The vote was 232 to 196, mostly on party lines, to approve a resolution that sets out rules for an impeachment process, a little more than a year before the 2020 elections.
Democratic California Congresswoman and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to the lawmakers, laying out the case for this historic vote. Here's part of her speech.
In March of this year, Speaker Pelosi said this about impeachment. Impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country. Today, the country just witnessed the only bipartisan vote on that floor was against. The question to the speaker are the same questions I provided in a letter about the unfair process that we had.
To protect our democracy, to keep our country united, the times have found each and every one of us in this room and in our country to pay attention to how we protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, honoring the vision of our founders who declared independence from a monarch and established a country contrary to that principle, honoring the men and women in uniform who fight for our flag and for our freedom and for our democracy, and honoring the aspirations of our children so that no president, whoever he or she may be in the future, could decide that Article 2 says they can do whatever they want. Again, let us honor our oath of office, let us defend our democracy, and have clarity as to how we proceed, why we proceed, and again, doing so in a way that honors the Constitution. We must honor the Constitution and how we do this. We must respect the institution we serve, and we must heed the further words of our founders, e pluribus unum, from any one. They didn't know how many we or how different we would be, but they knew that we needed to always be unifying. So hopefully as we go forward with this, with a clarity of purpose, a clarity of procedure, a clarity of fact, a clarity of truth, it's about the truth, it's about the Constitution, we will do so in a way that brings people together, that is healing rather than dividing, and that is how we will honor our oath of office.
And again, that was House Speaker Democratic Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi speaking to lawmakers today. This marked just the third time in modern history that the House took a vote on an impeachment inquiry into a sitting president. Two Democrats broke with their party to vote against it, while Republicans, under some immense pressure from President Trump to shut down the impeachment inquiry altogether, unanimously opposed it.
After the vote, the losing side spoke out. Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy harshly criticized Pelosi and the Democrats.
We just had a vote on the floor. In March of this year, Speaker Pelosi said this about impeachment. Impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country. Today, the country just witnessed the only bipartisan vote on that floor was against. The question to the speaker are the same questions I provided in a letter about the unfair process that we had. What has changed since March? In all the hearings, there's nothing compelling, nothing overwhelming. So the speaker should follow her own words on what bipartisan vote on that floor and end the sham that has been putting this country through this nightmare. That's exactly what this vote shows today.
That was Republican Congressman and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California.
Oregon Democratic Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici reacted to today's vote, saying, quote, The president must be held accountable for his actions. Evidence already uncovered, along with the president's own remarks, show betrayal of the Constitution and a threat to national security. The next phase of the impeachment inquiry will allow Oregonians and people across the country to witness the process designed by our founding fathers to uphold our values and maintain the checks and balances that are important to a functioning democracy.
Oregon Democratic Congressman Earl Blumenauer says, quote, "Today, the House set the stage for Trump to be held accountable with our impeachment vote. The American people will be able to watch the process and judge for themselves. Not surprisingly, no Republicans voted with us. When will my Republican colleagues have the courage to do in public what they must be thinking in private?"
And meantime, Oregon's only Republican in Congress, Greg Walden, had a very different take. He said, quote, "This has been a flawed process all along. It has lacked transparency and barred most members of Congress, myself included, from being able to access testimony from witnesses. If you are going to overturn a vote of the American people, it must be a fair and just process. This investigation has been neither, and this resolution is just another step in the overly partisan effort to impeach the president that started the day he was elected."
With today's vote behind them, Democratic leaders are aiming to finish public fact-finding hearings in the Intelligence Committee by around Thanksgiving. The Judiciary Committee would then have several weeks to draft articles of impeachment for a possible House vote before Christmas. Lawmakers leading the impeachment inquiry are trying to wrap up closed-door witness depositions with targets including John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor. They want to start public hearings in the Intelligence Committee the week of November 11th. The resolution that passed today lays out the rules for those hearings. It directs the Intelligence Committee to produce a public report of its findings and authorizes it to share all evidence with the Judiciary Committee. Lawmakers from both parties will weigh the evidence and debate whether it amounts to high crimes and misdemeanors.
As the costs of health care climb, the idea of Medicare for All is picking up steam politically. In fact, it's at the center of the presidential race already, as Laura Ross Bartellum reports.
Democratic presidential candidate Senator Elizabeth Warren visited the University of New Hampshire on Wednesday. She's been portrayed as having plans for many things, but not health care yet. Warren, like Senator Bernie Sanders, backs Medicare for All. It would be a single-payer, government-run health insurance system. When asked how it would be paid for, Senator Warren promised an answer is coming.
"How much is it going to cost? And how are we going to pay for it? Something I've been working on for a while now, and I'm going to put out a plan on it. And you can see it. You can see all of the numbers."
The latest poll conducted by the University of New Hampshire with CNN has Warren and Sanders leading the state. Recent polling from her home state of Massachusetts claims that more voters support a Medicare for All Who Want It option rather than a Medicare for All system. However, Warren suggests that Medicare for All wouldn't be as costly as critics claim it would be, and it would cost less for average Americans.
"We know that Medicare for All is the least expensive way to get everyone covered."
While many economists predict that premiums for individual plans may drop, some critics say the share of GDP spending on healthcare would increase drastically to pay for it. At the town hall, Warren also shared her existing plans to pay for childcare and education through a wealth tax on individuals with assets over $50 million. I'm Laura Ross Bartellum, reporting for Public News Service.
A comedian can have their own take on the upcoming presidential election, even a whole year out. Lily Bulkey takes a listen.
Excuse the audio quality to come. It's from a high-tech virtual reality town hall this week with comedian Ben Glebe.
"Happy Halloween, happy October. And hopefully, more importantly, a very happy November 2020.
The presidential primary candidate doesn't need his technology or approach to be perfect, but he wants political leadership challenging President Trump to think differently.
"You cannot beat Donald Trump in politics because, again, he's not a politician."
Today, 12 months away from the election, the House of Representatives formalizes some of the processes and rules for the impeachment inquiry into the incumbent president.
"Donald Trump is the greatest risk to our nation, but also the best trash talker in political history. I am not a politician or a greedy millionaire or billionaire, but I've dealt with narcissistic crybaby hecklers like Trump hundreds of times before.
Attending Glebe's event required downloading video game software called Sansar, creating an avatar, and using keyboard controls to get close to the stage where Avatar Glebe was speaking. Asked if he could have dinner with any president, dead or alive.
Taft, because he was a heavy man and probably ate delicious food.
Speaking of real food, in Iowa, people shake hands and take photos with candidates at Cafe Diem, where presidential hopefuls often visit. Owner Bill Malone's experience shows how surprising results in Iowa can be.
The first candidate that came through was Howard Dean, and he was the front runner at the time. And he came in, he packed the house, and it was a ton of fun. I was a big Howard Dean supporter. In fact, when I caucused for him and he didn't win Iowa, you could have knocked me over with a feather.
Howard Dean's so-called scream when he came in third almost 16 years ago is considered the first national viral event in politics. Malone prefers to hear from all sides.
If I had my preference, it'd be an open election every 4 years and we'd get them all. That's the most fun. And so when there's not an incumbent, generally speaking, you've got both parties trying really hard.
Political visits can be disruptive.
It does interrupt our business, but the coffee business is okay. It's not like people are having an Italian dinner and all of a sudden a political rally broke out.
Malone says that when people are just having coffee, along comes someone they've only seen on TV.
It's just a great thing. Even if it costs us, it would be worth it. So we love being a part of the community, being a part of Iowa, and we love this interaction, this political discourse.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
After months of negotiations, prosecutors will not seek the death penalty for the accused Portland Max killer, Jeremy Christian. This change comes after Oregon lawmakers passed Senate Bill 1013 last April. It limits how prosecutors can use the death penalty. This week, Multnomah County's district attorney filed a brief to change the charges against Christian so the alleged killer would not face the death penalty for stabbing and killing two men on a Max train. The victims were trying to stop him from yelling racist slurs at teenagers on a rush hour Max train in May of 2017. Christian faces two counts of aggravated murder and one count of attempted aggravated murder. Prosecutors are trying to alter those charges to two counts of murder in the first degree and one count of attempted murder in the first degree. Earlier this year, Christian's lawyers tried to have the trial moved out of state. The family of one of the victims has also filed a lawsuit against TriMet and Portland police for, they say, failing to keep Christian off of public transit despite previous reports of violence from passengers. The proposed changes to Christian's possible convictions still need a judge's signature to become final. His next court date is scheduled for tomorrow.
She served as a nurse in Portland but got busted for heroin trafficking. 60-year-old Renee Elaine Griffin Nunn from Vancouver, Washington, pleaded guilty today to one count of conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute controlled substances. Investigators say at the time of the crime, Nunn was working as a registered nurse at Adventist Medical Center in Portland. According to court documents, in February 2018, Nunn drove from Vancouver to Portland with about 93 grams of heroin in her purse. After a joint investigation of the Drug Enforcement Administration and the Clackamas County Interagency Task Force, officers found and arrested Nunn, who was driving into Portland. Nunn faces a maximum sentence of 20 years in prison, a $1 million fine, and 3 years of supervised release. She will be sentenced in February.
Just like public health officials, law enforcement agencies are trying to figure out the dangers of illegal vaping products and who is selling them. Mike Moan reports experts in law enforcement are predicting a growing black market for vaping.
States are investigating a rise in vaping-related issues and have even declared emergencies. In addition to efforts by the medical community, law enforcement agencies are tracking down operations that sell illegal vaping products. Tim Fornair is the police chief in New Hope, a Twin Cities suburb. He says there are still a lot of unknowns, but agencies are beginning to connect the dots. Officers from his department recently worked with a task force that netted more than 76,000 vaping cartridges containing THC, a chemical found in marijuana.
What we busted up were the most popular brand of illegal and underground produced cartridge, where it doesn't have the regulation attached to the manufacturing.
A similar bust was recently reported by Wisconsin authorities. That operation was described by investigators as one of the biggest illegal vaping rings in the country. Public health officials are trying to differentiate between potential causes of illness from legal vaping products and those laced with THC. The Minnesota Department of Health has seen 3 deaths and more than 80 cases of vaping-related lung injury and is reviewing 39 others. Warnair says until more information is collected and policymakers enact more regulations, police will continue to track down tips and educate the public about the potential dangers of vaping, especially off-market products.
What we can do in the meantime, what we have been doing is working with our local schools, working with our local youth. The resources are more educational at this point, I think, than in an enforcement capacity.
Foreign Air adds, even if more regulations are in place, black markets can still thrive. For example, he says in states where marijuana has been legalized, there's added cost for the product sold in dispensaries, which can make underground markets more attractive to buyers looking for cheaper products. He says a similar scene could develop for vaping products containing dangerous chemicals. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
2 weeks after the Oregon Court of Appeals stopped Governor Kate Brown's ban on flavored nicotine vaping products, a cannabis distributor has filed a lawsuit challenging the ban on flavored weed vapes. The motion is from Urban Industries Oregon, a major cannabis distributor that operates in several states, including Oregon. It's the sole distributor of the brand Winberry Farms, one of the dominant flavored cartridge manufacturers in Oregon. Willamette Week reports the Court of Appeals must now decide whether there's proof that the ban has caused irreparable harm to the business. The stay requested today follows a pattern set by the nicotine plaintiffs 2 weeks prior. Both groups have argued the ban will cause irreparable harm to their business.
A national nonprofit industry trade association and a Washington vape shop have also filed a lawsuit against Washington State. They're trying to stop its ban on flavored vapor products. The suit from Vapor Technology Association and Barron Enterprises is trying to declare the state's emergency ruling on vaping invalid. Earlier this month, the Washington State Department of Health and the State Board of Health put an emergency ban on the sale, purchase, and advertisement of flavored vapor products. The ban would extend until February 7, 2020. VTA says the emergency rule would destroy Washington's $484 million nicotine vapor products industry and ruin the livelihoods of 3,400 workers that it employs. The suit also claims that the ban will create a public health crisis as people who vape go to the black market.
A new plan aims to fund health care delivered outside the doctor's office. As Mark Richardson reports, the Dell Medical Center will study an initiative to prove the value of care outside of traditional settings.
A new initiative seeks to improve a patient's health without a visit to a doctor or hospital. The Factor Health Program at the University of Texas at Austin's Dell Medical School, funded by a $2.6 million grant from the Episcopal Health Foundation, aligns unconventional partners to identify proven pay for non-medical care outside of traditional settings. For example, the program might use a healthy meal delivery system to change a diabetic's diet to healthier food, lower their blood glucose levels, and have a health insurance plan pay for it. Elena Marks with the Episcopal Health Foundation says they aim to improve outcomes while cutting costs outside of a clinical setting.
So our role is funding what's essentially an experiment backed up with a lot of data collection and evaluation with the hope that if it proves true, it becomes incorporated into the healthcare financing system.
The program brings together an unusual group of players, including managed care payers such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield, social service providers such as Meals on Wheels, and grassroots youth development organizations such as Youth Rise Texas. Mark says the first two programs to be tested through the Dell School would be managing diabetes for older adults and addressing the mental health impacts of family separation on high school age youth. She says the goal is to prove the value of such programs to the people who pay the bills.
People have done all sorts of things around diet and exercise to impact diabetes. What's different about this is that we are trying to get it embedded in the healthcare delivery system so that it gets financed as part of healthcare.
Mark says the goal is to demonstrate that if non-medical interventions can bring results, then they're worth something to a health insurance company.
The main thing behind it really goes to the core of what Episcopal Health Foundation is trying to do, and that is to change the conversation and the financing so that we actually are prioritizing health and not just health care.
She says the foundation will study the data and outcomes of the first two programs over a one-year period and consider funding new programs after that. For Public News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
With 4,000 listings last year, Airbnb is the largest vacation rental platform that operates in Portland. Tomorrow, a new registration system will take effect for Portland users, putting the company on track to meet a deadline set by the city to start disclosing information about its short-term rental hosts. This new registration system is intended to cut down on rental hosts who operate without a permit and avoid lodging taxes and regulatory oversight. The system will require hosts to reapply through the company's system to allow disclosure to the city or add their city short-term rental permit to their listing page. According to Portland's Office of Management and Finance, Airbnb must delist any existing hosts that don't consent to sharing their data by January 1st. Laura Spangian, a senior public policy director at Airbnb, says the new system will streamline the permit process. She says, quote, "We know that hosting on Airbnb is an important source of supplemental income for many Portland families. So we're hopeful this updated registration system will make it easier for hosts to obtain permits and share their homes."
A program that aims to help the houseless in the Vancouver area is getting a $55,000 grant. The money will help the group called Share in Vancouver buy a truck for its Talk and Trash program. It'll buy the Dodge truck to transport half a dozen community cleaners and their supervisor as they clear waste from houseless campsites near downtown Vancouver.
New numbers show hundreds of thousands of children are without health insurance, and the rate's been climbing the last 2 years. Suzanne Potter reports on how it's impacting more than 250,000 kids along the West Coast.
For the second year in a row, the percentage of uninsured kids has stagnated in the Golden State and is going up nationwide, according to a new report. Researchers from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families found that 3.1% of California's kids, about 300,000 children, have no health insurance. Myra Alvarez with the Children's Partnership says we should be doing better considering the state increased premium subsidies and extended Medi-Cal to everyone younger than 26, regardless of immigration status.
California has taken multiple proactive steps to expand coverage, but we aren't making a dent in the number of uninsured kids in California, despite the fact that the economy has been strong.
The report says the number of uninsured kids increased by 400,000 children nationwide between 2016 and 2018. The authors blame the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, as well as President Trump's anti-immigrant policies, which have led many parents to drop their kids from government programs. Joan Alker with the Georgetown Center says the loss of coverage hurt Latino children the most, but several other groups also saw decreases in coverage.
White children also had a significant loss of coverage, young children under age 6, and that's really troubling. And we're also seeing families who are just right above the poverty lines with incomes around $30,000 a year, those working poor families losing coverage.
Nationwide, the rate of uninsured kids went from 4.7% in 2016 to 5.2% in 2018, leaving a total of 4 million American children uninsured. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Firefighters are battling 12 large wildfires in 4 states, affecting more than 113,000 acres. Half of the big fires are in California. That's where firefighters are continuing to battle fires up and down the state, including several that began overnight. One of them, a new blaze known as the Hillside Fire, forced residents to flee as strong winds drove the flames. So far this year, wildfires have scorched more than 4.5 million acres. Other large wildfires are burning right now in Arizona, Colorado, and Utah.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Blackbird School, a local startup that focuses on teaching teachers how they can teach computer programming. At 6, it's time for Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, stay tuned for the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, we're going to drop close to that freezing mark with a low of about 33 degrees under clear skies. Tomorrow's weather, more clear skies and sunshine, a high of about 59. The weekend's looking sunny too, with highs near 50. Today in history, on this date in 2011, the global population of humans reached 7 billion. This day is now recognized by the United Nations as the Day of 7 Billion. Our quote of the day is from Aristotle, the Greek philosopher who lived in the 300s. He said, "Excessive population growth may reduce output per worker, repress levels of living for the masses, and engender strife."
A new report shows the skyrocketing cost of rent is an increasing burden for Americans, especially in bigger cities. The number of cost-burdened renter households jumped by almost 300,000 between 2017 and 2018, according to the report from Apartment List. Nadia Ramlagan has more.
Nearly half of all renter households nationwide are now shelling out more than 30% of their income on rent, according to a new report by Apartment List. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, spending more than 30% of your income on housing means you're cost burdened. Housing economist Chris Salviati says this is the first time renter cost burden has increased since 2014.
This jump that we have seen over the past year, I think, does really speak to the worsening of the housing affordability issue. If you're following the 2020 primaries, you know, virtually all of the Democratic candidates now have plans that they've released to address the housing affordability crisis.
Salviati points to cities with lots of good high-paying jobs, but lacking the housing infrastructure needed to keep up with demand. He says cities across the country are experiencing similar growing pains. There's also the issue of home ownership. Salviati notes it's becoming increasingly difficult for people in their 20s and 30s to purchase their first home, and that's having a ripple effect on renting costs.
There has been a severe lack of new construction, particularly for starter homes, and so millennials and folks who are reaching an age and point in their careers where maybe previously they would have been purchasing homes, a lot are continuing to rent, and so that does add this tightness to the rental market, which drives up prices.
Renters are shelling out 34.1% of their income on housing. Salviati says that should be an eye-opener when considering where to live,
which again is well above that 30% threshold.
The report also found that nationwide, the cost of median rent grew faster than renter income for the first time in nearly a decade. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Two Portland bars are being sued for copyright infringement. The American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers is suing two Southwest Portland bars, the Cider Mill Lounge and the Rialto Pool Room, over unauthorized performance of copyrighted compositions by society members. The ASCAP requires a license averaging less than $2 a day for venues to hold public performances of any song in its repertoire. The alleged infractions in both locations took place in August. The songs listed in the suit include Too Close by Alex Clare and Plush by Stone Temple Pilots. It's unclear from the lawsuit whether these songs were performed by live acts or pre-recorded and played over the bar's speakers. Damages for this lawsuit range from $750 to $30,000. According to Willamette Week, the ASCAP often takes legal action against venues. 19 venues across the country were targeted in the latest round of lawsuits, with Cider Mill and Rialto being two of them.
It was the first time a river in America got special protections. As Ross Brown reports, almost a century later, the fight continues for the Gila River.
I'm Dr. Anthony.
Nearly half of all renter households nationwide are now shelling out more than 30% of their income on rent, according to a new report by Apartment List. According to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, spending more than 30% of your income on housing means you're cost burdened. Housing economist Chris Salviati said,
95 years ago, the Gila area in southwest New Mexico received the first ever wilderness designation. Now, a coalition wants to make sure additional protections extend to the Gila River. A delegation of New Mexico residents is in Washington, D.C. today to ask Senators Tom Udall and Martin Heinrich to champion a bill for wild and scenic designation to protect the Gila and San Francisco rivers and their tributaries. Harry Brown is a commissioner in Grant County, where the Gila is located. He says support for the wild and scenic designation is very broad.
We've got old hippies, we've got business people, townsfolk and rural folk, hunters and hikers. All of these sectors of our community want to see the Gila River protected for future generations.
The delegation meeting with the senators includes local elected officials and representatives of Native American tribes, sportsmen's groups, and small business owners. Grant County has already passed its own resolution to support wild and scenic designation, which only Congress can decide. It would not affect existing grazing and ranching operations in the area. The Gila Wilderness is considered by many to be one of America's best-kept secrets, but it's also famous for solitude and night skies unblemished by light pollution. Jamie Crockett is the co-owner of Gila Backcountry Services and takes visitors on guided camping trips. She notes that Gila is one of the largest undammed watersheds in the lower 48 states.
As a community, we see the wild and scenic designation as a way that we can add an additional protection to the water in the river and its traditional uses.
Annually, outdoor recreation generates nearly $10 billion in consumer spending in New Mexico, including $3 billion in wages and salaries. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
There's new hope for protections for native lands from oil and gas development and mining. With that story and much more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily report dedicated to indigenous news, issues, and culture.
Tribal leaders in the Southwest are praising the passage of a bill to protect Chaco Canyon in New Mexico. The U.S. House Wednesday passed the Chaco Cultural Heritage Area Protection Act, which would remove public lands managed by the federal government within an area of about 10 miles outside of Chaco Culture National Historical Park from future oil and gas leases. Edward Paul Torres, chair of the All Pueblo Council of Governors, says pueblos in New Mexico and Texas are tied to the area, and its protection is vital to Pueblo communities. Similar legislation is in the Senate. A bill to protect the Grand Canyon from development also passed the House Wednesday. The Havasupai tribe in Arizona is among supporters of the bill to protect federal lands adjacent to Grand Canyon National Park and the tribe's reservation from new uranium mining. The South Dakota Water Management Board has set certain guidelines to consider water use for the Keystone XL pipeline. The board is hearing one legal consideration at a time for Three Rivers. On the fourth day of hearings, testimony centered on the first consideration, water quantity and availability. However, when a witness is not available to come back for each consideration, he or she can be heard out of turn to address topics such as public good and beneficial use. Wednesday morning started with one such witness, as Victoria Wicks reports.
Intervenor Elizabeth Lone Eagle calls Joseph Bringsplenty, a traditional chief and law enforcement officer on the Cheyenne River Reservation. He begins to testify about the historical and spiritual uses of water when he is interrupted by TC Energy attorney William Taylor, who seeks a standing objection.
It's our opinion that testimony regarding the impact of the completed KXL pipeline on subjects like global warming, climate change, air pollution, public safety, tribal heritage sites is irrelevant to the matters that are an issue in this hearing.
Taylor says state law restricts permit considerations to the immediate and proximate effect of water use and not the potential damage the completed project might cause. The board chairman denies Taylor's request and then Bringsplenty continues his testimony, pointing out that water is used in ceremonies such as a nepi or sweat.
We take in buckets of water with us and we use them to put on the toka or the rocks, and it creates a steam in what we believe is our relative's breath, po, you know, and what we do is we breathe that in.
Bringsplenty says this ceremony is meant to cleanse the people, and contaminated water might make them sick. After Bringsplenty testifies, TC Energy continues calling witnesses to explain how the water requested in the permit would be used for construction. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
It's been about 2 months since the Cherokee Nation announced its intention to send a delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives, which is a treaty promise. Caroline Halter has an update on the process.
Cherokee Nation nominated former Obama advisor Kim Teehee as its congressional delegate in late August. Since then, Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. says he's met with a handful of lawmakers, including Oklahoma Representatives Tom Cole and Marquaine Mullen and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi.
All of those meetings were very encouraging because the questions that were not posed in a manner to suggest that we shouldn't be able to do this. It was a question of how would we get it done.
Hoskins says there are two options for seating Teehee. Pelosi could do it by changing the House rules, which could be easily undone, or Congress could pass a law like it's done for delegates from U.S. territories. Either way, Hoskins hopes the process won't take more than a year. I'm Caroline Halter.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Nearly a quarter of the world's pigs are expected to die in an epidemic of African swine fever, or ASF. The spread of the disease in the past year has taken policymakers by surprise, and the effects have been dramatic in China, which is home to the largest pig population in the world. The crisis means that global pork prices are rising, pushed largely from demand in China. There, nearly 100 million pigs have been lost since the disease broke out there last year, according to China's official inventory. Veterinary scientists have been looking for a vaccine for the disease, but its spread has created unique challenges. For one, while the disease cannot be spread to humans, it is basically 100% fatal once embedded in pig populations. It can be transmitted through direct contact or through ticks, but the virus can also worryingly survive several months in processed meat and several years in frozen carcasses. The virus has been identified in 50 countries, including Russia, South Korea, and the Philippines. Dr. Mike Shipp, the vice president for the World Organization for Animal Health, told a press conference this week that African swine fever was, quote, the biggest threat to any commercial livestock of our generation. Though some suggestions from the Chinese government have indicated improvement, global analysts say that the losses and the spread so far make the deficit in pork a problem for the foreseeable future.
Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has offered that his country host this year's United Nations climate talks in Madrid after Chile pulled out. Chile's President Sebastián Piñera announced the offer from Sanchez today, just one day after he suddenly withdrew from hosting the meeting in Santiago next month. Massive protests against Piñera's government and social inequality have caused disruption across Chile. Piñera says Chile would still preside over the conference, calling Spain's offer a generous solution. UN Climate Change Executive Secretary Patricia Espinosa says she's hopeful top climate diplomats from several countries could meet and consider the solution as soon as possible. Chile's unrest has brought thousands of people to the streets, and the army's been deployed in the capital. The calls for a fairer system have been met with widespread violence, leaving at least 18 killed. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet says she will investigate allegations of human rights violations.
It's creepy. Just look at the calendar. On this October 31st, Halloween, arguably the creepiest day of the year. But it doesn't have to just be a creepy and scary holiday. It can also be a teaching moment for children. We find out more from this report about National Geographic for Kids.
Insight Daily Radio. Conversations with today's most influential authors, actors, musicians, artists, and creative minds.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
Just in time for Halloween, National Geographic Kids is releasing That's Creepy, spine-tingling facts that will test your creep-out factor. Filled with facts, eerie anecdotes, and fun information. It's got everything creepy, kooky, mysterious, and spooky, but with real science and history. We caught up with Becky Baines from National Geographic to fill us in.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
What surprised me? I think a lot of it surprised me. I really found the alien section to be really kind of enlightening and also kind of funny. There's a whole section on, we've all heard of, alien encounters. And what I didn't realize is there's actually a chart that exists that explains what each kind of encounter means. So like an encounter of the first kind is seeing a UFO, where an encounter of the fourth kind is being abducted by a UFO and its crew, and an encounter of the seventh kind is actually starting a family with an alien. So there are actually people out there that have taken this information and kind of categorized it in really interesting ways. It's become like a standard of how you refer to things as obscure as alien encounters. So I found that really interesting.
That was Becky Baines with that creepy report about National Geographic for Kids. Happy Halloween.
We'll be right back.
Foundation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. For tonight's newscast, our producer is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Chris Gates. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Full Lomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned for News in Depth coming up next, where we will be hearing about a startup that aims to teach teachers how to, in turn, teach kids about computer programming.
It's a Portland-based startup with the goal of teaching teachers how they can teach kids to program. The founder of the online Blackbird School, Ness Blackbird, is making programming accessible in rural areas and for minorities across Oregon. Using easy and interactive tools to include both students and teachers, Blackbird School is trying to make what was once a solitary activity for a few into an approachable and fun way to learn for us all. KBOO's Nat Moon talks to Ness Blackbird for this in-depth interview.
Blackbird School is a really exciting project, which is solving a problem that has pretty complex roots.
I am sitting here with Ness Blackbird of the Blackbird School. Thank you for joining us today, Ness. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Great. So we brought you in here to tell us a little bit about what you do. So can you tell us about what you do and what Blackbird School itself functions as?
Blackbird School is online software which is used in the classroom for teaching computer programming.
Blackbird School provides support for teachers, right? So Blackbird School will teach teachers how to then teach their students how to program.
That's exactly right. The exciting thing about Blackbird School, which is really different, is that for a teacher to teach with Blackbird School, they don't need a background in programming. They can just pick it up and learn right along with their students. We've made programming very accessible so that what we find is that students are very engaged with it. They really enjoy learning it. And this is not just kind of the geeks, the really smart kids. This is all the kids. From middle school onward, we found that students are really just enjoying it. We've been running pilot programs in Arleta Middle School and Jefferson High School. And in Arleta in particular, I mean, we have a big class full of middle school kids. They're actually mostly sixth graders. And it's class is taught by a biology teacher who has learned programming just, you know, from Blackbird School. And it's going really well. The kids have learned an amazing amount. You know, what we find is that they'll actually, you know, you have a long class sometimes, and, you know, you call a break after an hour, and the kids will just stick around over the break and just keep programming because they're having a great time.
So one thing that I found really interesting about Blackbird School is that it teaches coding in a fun and friendly way. Yeah. Can you describe that a little bit for our listeners?
Well, the first thing to understand is that every lesson, every step of every lesson, everything that you can do, the system will respond to you in a way that you can understand. The problem with the way that most of this kind of software works is that it's using an unmodified programming language. And programming languages, these are engineering tools. This is true of all the programming languages that are out there, Python, JavaScript, all of them. They're made for engineering, and they're not made for teaching. So what we've had to do is we've written a version of JavaScript which is made for teaching. It's still JavaScript. It's the real thing. But it's a teaching version so that mistakes that you make, it will respond in a friendly way. And then what we've done is we've put this into lessons, and we've written a fairly sophisticated lesson processing system, a lesson presentation system. It gives you suggestions. It gives you hints. If you can't figure it out, it'll just tell you the right answer, and you move along. And then you'll kind of circle back around until you feel really comfortable with it.
Why do you think it's important for young students to learn how to code?
God, I mean, you know, this is the world that we're in today, right? I mean, these kids, they grow up using their phones and computers and stuff all day long. For them to have a sense of mastery and control that they can make these things do what they want, they're not just consumers. They're building the world that they're gonna be in as adults. Of course, everybody knows that, you know, developer jobs, these are very good jobs. They pay very well, and unfortunately, we've seen a situation where most of those jobs are going to a narrow slice of people. They're mostly white guys, mostly from advantaged backgrounds. And Blackbird School aims to change that, and we really feel that we can, because we've made this accessible enough. You can put it in any school. We can go to, and we are going to, rural school districts, bringing it to kids that have not expected that they were going to be learning this. So, you know, if we have listeners in rural areas, I invite you to call us. We will come out there. We will make sure that you have everything that you need to teach this. We want to go to Native American reservations, to schools around Portland and around the country, and indeed around the world, where, you know, there's different minorities. We're in Jefferson. We've been working with, there's a big variety of kids in Jefferson, and they're doing really well. They kind of come in all different colors and genders and all kinds of stuff there. And we're very excited that the class is doing great. Again, it's like mostly when you talk about like success stories of learning programming, you're talking about the one kid, or maybe like the two kids that figured it out. Because with most systems, it's just really challenging because they're using technology that's difficult to work with. The reasons for that, I think, are kind of complicated, but what we're kind of here to say is, you know, you can make this technology really accessible, and we believe that we have. Like most people who learn to program, I learned it on my own. I mean, if you ask computer programmers, 75% will say that they are at least partly self-taught. That is pretty much the norm among programmers. You have to figure it out on your own, because honestly, the educational systems that we have in place don't make it accessible enough for most people to just kind of learn in class. You really kind of need to go home and obsess. And so that's what is happening these days, is that programming is being learned by people who obsess about it. That's the world of today. And that does create problems, because our developers come from a narrow slice of like people from a mental point of view. I mean, to be blunt, most of us are on the spectrum. And, you know, we tend to look at programming as kind of an end in itself because we love it. We love it. And that's why we stuck with it long enough that we were actually able to learn it. I mean, we're not actually smart. Don't listen to anybody who says that developers are smarter than other people. It's not true. What we are is we're obsessed. And when you're obsessed, you get very good at something. That's how it goes. Back to where I was.
Well, let me ask you this question. Yeah. So coding, like you mentioned, coding is an obsession for you. So for you, starting Blackbird School, was that sort of an intersection of trying to provide coding, which is something you love, to students who are not the prime audience for minorities and women, basically?
Well, they haven't been. But, I mean, the educational system wants them to be. I mean, the educational system has put a lot of energy into trying to figure out how to teach coding to more people and, you know, kind of get it out there. There is a sense that, like, we have to figure out. There are many, I think there's, like, 24 states or something that have got, like, learn to code initiatives of some kind or other going on. you know, the world of education feels that this is really important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at Blackbird School, I mean, we just feel like we've got something to add here to it.
What's next for you? What's next for Blackbird School?
Blackbird School is really just getting started. You know, we have three or four classes going on right now, and we're talking to a number of schools and people. And so the next thing is we want to spread rapidly around Portland and then Oregon and then the United States and then the world. Blackbird School, our hope is to, we will be looking for investment funding in the near future, assuming that things kind of keep going on track, you know, so because it takes a lot of money to be, you know, advertising and getting yourself known across all 50 states and stuff, which is our plan for the near future.
The software itself is available to anybody.
That is correct. Yeah. If you just want to learn programming on your own, then you can just go to blackbird.school. That's www.blackbird.school. There's no com in there. It's just .school. And you can sign up, pay $10 a month for an account, and learn to program.
That's awesome. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners today?
We would encourage parents in particular to call us and talk to us about how to get our system into your kids' schools. We find that the easiest way for us to get the attention of a school is by way of the parents. I mean, it's actually very difficult. We don't have actually salespeople. What we have is teachers. So we just hire teachers to go in and teach people how to use Blackbird School. I mean, it's less of sort of a convincing sales process and more of a, we're trying to sell something which is very much needed. So there's not like convincing isn't needed. We just have teachers that go out and say, here it is. I'm a teacher. I'm using this to learn and I'm using it to teach. It works for me. It can work for you.
So you're leading by example pretty much.
Yeah. The one thing I would invite is for people who are teaching computer science today, if you want to get a look at what we're doing, go to blackbird.school and look at the free playground. That is, you know, where students go to practice and play around and make their own things, and that it's a very friendly environment. A lot of computer science teachers have, you know, they have a lot of different software in their classrooms that they'll invite kids to use, and this can be sort of one more thing that you can have in your tool chest, and I think you'll see that there's something special about it. Yeah, I guess one more thing I would throw in there is just that, you know, our goal is we want to create a more happier and more peaceful world by reducing income inequality. And that's really why we started the company. All of us in Blackbird School are, you know, really kind of pulling together and behind that goal that we feel really strongly about, and we feel really happy because we believe we have a chance to achieve it.
Well, Ness, thank you so much for speaking with us today. This is Ness Blackbird, the president of Blackbird School. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Nat Moon. The top of 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 the top of
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest and Arcadia Beats host Hip Hop Halloween, featuring performers Figure 8 AF, Contra Killas, and Dub Dynamic, a costume contest, tarot readings, and more. Project Northwest is a pro-black, pro-women, pro-queer online zine and showcase for hip-hop and R&B artists in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd, from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell us an Indian first then?